You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of July 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a presidential boycott. Pakistan is about to choose its new head of state, but one party isn't taking part. We'll ask how bad the damage could be.
We also set the day's agenda in the Far East with our Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears. What do you have for us today, Aisha?
Today we'll be looking at whether the editors of the Apple Daily will face imprisonment, muddy turf for Hong Kong football, and whether eating some greens could be bad for you.
Also on the show, what have darkness and polar bears got in common? Author Paul Bogard joins us to talk about how true dark is an endangered species and what we're losing with all the lights on.
If we're thinking of natural darkness, the way it was before electric light, that darkness is gone from every major city in the world.
We'll also check in with the Monocle voice in Papua New Guinea. We'll play some music too, and we'll go through the front pages of the British newspapers. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So that is your next hour. Your next few minutes, though, will be Barney Burnham. Here's your news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. More than 100 Taliban fighters and seven suicide bombers have attacked a prison in northwestern Pakistan. A Taliban spokesman claims around 300 prisoners were freed in the attack. Hundreds of Taliban and militants from other band groups are held in the jail in the town of Dera Ismail Khan. The attack began with a series of explosions around midnight on Monday. Gunmen then opened fire with machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. The town's civil commissioner says 14 of the escaped prisoners were recaptured and 30 were hardened militants. Talks have resumed between Israeli officials and Palestinians at a dinner in Washington. The initial discussions, hosted by the United States, are being described as an important step towards full peace talks. More meetings will take place later today. Israel's chief negotiator, Tzipi Livni, says her country can't afford to be optimistic, but she is hopeful.
We are after about 4 years of stagnation. And in the past we negotiated, but we didn't reach a dead end. So basically I hope that there is a better understanding now that this is the interest of both our peoples to reach an agreement and to end this conflict.
Supporters of the deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi have vowed to hold further protests today despite the bloodshed at the weekend when 80 Islamist supporters were gunned down. In a bid to end the violence, the EU's top diplomat has held talks with Egypt's interim rulers and the Muslim Brotherhood. Catherine Ashton met General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the head of the army, and also held talks with representatives of the Freedom and Justice Party, the Brotherhood's political wing. In the United States, the White House has condemned the latest violence. Spokesman Joseph Earnest.
It's the view of the United States that Egyptian authorities have a moral and legal obligation to respect the right of peaceful assembly and freedom of expression. And violence not only further sets back the process of reconciliation and democratization in Egypt, but it will negatively impact regional stability.
The sheriff's office in Lake County, Central Florida, says all the workers at a propane gas factory near Orlando have now been accounted for and nobody has been killed after a series of large explosions. The blasts, which were felt up to 10 miles away, caused local roads to be closed and homes to be evacuated. Seven people were injured. Lawmakers in Britain say the battle against internet crime is being lost, and they're calling for the establishment of a new crack crime unit to fight the growing problem in cooperation with the UK's global partners, particularly the European Union. A report by the Parliamentary Home Affairs Committee said the state-of-the-art espionage response team would encourage companies, banks and institutions to report hacking attempts to uncover the full extent of online crime and halt its rise. The report also said that the committee was concerned that there appears to be a black hole where low-level e-crime is committed with impunity. The countdown to Brazil hosting the next Summer Olympics has begun, with a ceremony to mark 1,100 days until the event. At an event at the United Nations, a year after London hosted the Games, the UK's ambassador to the UN, Mark Lyle Grant, handed a symbolic baton to Luiz Alberto Figueiredo Machado, the ambassador from Brazil.
For my country, it is both a huge satisfaction and a very healthy challenge to succeed the United Kingdom in the organization of the Summer Olympic and Paralympic Games. The London Games, without any doubt, will serve as an inspiration for my country and for all future hosts of the Games.
And those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. The time is just coming up to 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And it's time now to set the day's agenda. Three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears, joins us now. Aisha, welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm positively chipper, thank you. Emma, you?
Oh, absolutely splendid.
There we go. We're all doing well, so that's a good start. And where would you like to start us off today, Aisha?
I'm going to start with a story that's just broken, which is that Justice Rimsky-Yen, the Secretary for Justice here in Hong Kong, has requested that the High Court imprison editors of the Apple Daily for contempt of court. Now, the Apple Daily, I sadly can't read it because I can't read Chinese, but it is read by everyone, I'm told, in Hong Kong. It's kind of a mix of tabloid and also investigative journalism. They have their own video site. It's a big, big read here. And what's happened is they have interviewed a guy called Henry Chow, who's accused of murdering and dismembering his parents, and they've done this before the situation actually has gone to jury, which rules out the possibility of it being tried by jury because so many of the people will know the story already.
How common a practice is this? I mean, that basic journalistic alarm bells ring as soon as you mention anything about talking to murderers, before, during or after trials. It strikes me as a very odd thing to have happened.
Indeed. I mean, the Apple Daily is a little bit sensationalist and a little bit anti-government, so it seems that they probably aren't people who are going to go by the rules every day. They're not the BBC, let's put it that way. But they had already spoken to this man called Henry Chow when his parents had gone missing. He had spoken to them on their video site saying that his father had gone missing and he was worried about him. It then turned out that he had murdered his mother and father for very strange reasons. One of them apparently is that he said it was because they forced him to read the SCMP, the South China Morning Post, when he was a child, instead of letting him go and play. And this was all documented by the Apple Daily. They indeed visited him at his psychiatric ward and spoke to him there too. And so the government here is very upset that they've managed to breach this this trust that they should have with the courts.
And presumably that will have an effect on not just the paper, but other newspapers as well, on the industry more broadly. We in the UK are familiar with the behaviour of caution from newspapers after a big scandal. I wonder what the effect might be there.
Well, it's a funny thing to assess at the moment because so much has been written and spoken about the government cracking down on press freedom, where this doesn't seem to be a case of press freedom. This seems to be a very clear rule that this paper has broken. But July 1st, the protest that we've mentioned a few times, a lot of the things that people were talking about there were fears of press freedom eroding. Lots of journalists are saying that they think that it's become worse in the last few years. And there's a new law that went into effect this year that said journalists can now be jailed for up to 5 years or fined up to $1 million Hong Kong if they reveal information that causes psychological harm or loss. So while this is a very different case, it might be a situation where you've got journalists who are so afraid of, you know, they're so angry that they're not allowed to say certain things that they're going to keep publishing things even though perhaps it's not in their best intentions to legally.
Aisha, let's move on to a subject which I know that both you and I are massive fans of, football. Yesterday, Manchester United played in Hong Kong and there was an enormous amount of complaint about the state of the pitch, not necessarily from the players themselves, but there's been an awful lot of speculation about the state of the pitch, which could in fact harm Hong Kong's chances of attracting foreign teams to play.
Indeed, Emma, you would have loved to have been here because it's been a week of football, and clearly you do love football.
I couldn't think of anything nicer, Aisha.
And so last week I was at the Grand Hyatt Hotel, and it was a buzz with all sorts of reporters and fans waiting for Premier League players who were staying at the hotel. Yesterday, going through Causeway Bay, it was packed with Manchester United fans going to Hong Kong Stadium. It's been the Barclays Asia Trophy here. It was between the 24th and the 27th of July. Man City were in town, Sunderland and Tottenham Hotspur, and they were playing with South China. And then yesterday, Manchester United played, and they were all playing at Hong Kong Stadium. The problem is that during the tournament, one of the Spurs players apparently got an ankle injury. There's been all sorts of complaint that the quality of grass is just awful at the stadium. And indeed, people are worried that it will stop international tournaments being played here in Hong Kong.
The Premier League, or English football in general, is a sort of enormous juggernaut of money-sprinkling business that seems to go all over the world, particularly in the sort of mid-season lull. I wonder how much concern is there for that juggernaut potentially not coming back?
Exactly. Well, that is the main issue. The Hong Kong Stadium is run by the government. They have a lot of money. They have a huge surplus. So I think when things like this happen, people are often angry as to why are you not maintaining the pitch in the right way. A recent survey was done, a recent visit to two government-run and one privately-run stadium, showing that the government-run ones are really bad. They apparently use the wrong type of sand that's mixed with the grass, so it's much rougher sand. There's poor maintenance, whereas the private ones are spiked and cut regularly. And indeed, Manchester United chose to practice at one of these privately run stadiums to avoid the threat of injury. So there is a huge new multi-purpose sports venue being opened at the site of the old Kai Tak Airport. That'll be opened in 2019. So people are kind of waiting for then, and they think that by that stage there's going to be a whole new facility to attract international sport. But until then, they want their current pitches to be maintained well.
What I found so interesting about it was the fact that the Home Affairs Secretary has now got involved and has promised an overhaul of the pitch. It's very strange to think that you know, such hugely profitable private ventures such as football teams can actually get some help from the local authorities. How much of an involvement do these state authorities have in football in Hong Kong?
A huge not necessarily simply just in football, but Hong Kong is covered in public sports facilities. I mean, it might be too hot to actually use them half of the year, but there are basketball courts everywhere. There are football courts. The parks are well maintained. If you want to go and have a game of tennis, you don't have to pay a huge amount of money and wait for days to get on the list like you might do in other cities. You can go and you can sign up and you can play a game of tennis here in Hong Kong. So I think people expect their government to provide them with facilities to do this. The government says they are going to get involved. That they have a consultant firm they're working with in New Zealand. Apparently, I'm no grass expert, obviously, but apparently the best type of grass is Bermuda grass to use in this type of stadium where there's a lot of rain and there's not much sun. So they're going to get some more grass. Hopefully they'll take some lessons from the privately run stadiums and get the right kind of sand. I'll do a little bit more exploration into what makes a good turf and let you guys know.
A little bit more digging down into the turf.
If I ever needed to open a football stadium, you would be the first girl I'd ring.
Aisha, we did promise three topics and we should briefly talk about the third. We'll stay on the subject of greens, though, slightly more dangerous greens, though, potentially.
Indeed, so the Health Bureau here have said that you shouldn't stir-fry your greens, which seems obvious, but rather than a kind of high-fat intake because of the oil, there's a new threat, which is acrylamide, I think that's how you say it, which apparently is a huge cancer causer. Cancer is the number one cause of death here in Hong Kong. And so if you fry everything from zucchinis to green peppers, even your onions and your garlic, if you fry it a lot, it's going to get this contaminant. So instead, you should boil them or steam them. I think we kind of knew that already. Apparently, it's newsworthy now, though.
I think we did, but being told not to eat our greens is... different. Aisha Spears in Hong Kong, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Coming up, we'll speak to our woman in Pakistan who's in London at the moment on what to expect from the presidential elections taking place today. Stay with us.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time in Islamabad is 15 minutes past midday. Here in London, it's 8:15 a.m. And it is to Pakistan where we head next. As voting is underway in the country's presidential elections, the poll among the country's lawmakers is unlikely to yield any surprise when it comes to the outcome. Mamnoon Hussain is a textile businessman and member of the ruling Pakistan Muslim League N Party. He's poised to take over from Asif Ali al-Zardari, whose term in office ends in September.
Now, the controversy lies in the manner in which the election is being held. It was brought forward by a week, and as a result, some candidates are claiming that they haven't had enough time to campaign. It's led to the PPP, the Pakistani People's Party, who were in power until earlier this year, saying they'll boycott the vote. Joining us in the studio is our regular contributor, Samira Shackle, who's normally in Pakistan, but she's in London for the moment. How are you, Samira?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thanks very much. Explain to us the sort of difference. We had the prime ministerial elections some weeks ago. This is a very different beast, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not a direct election, so you don't have the public voting for their president. The public vote for the lawmakers, as we saw in May, and then the lawmakers vote for the president. It's largely a ceremonial role, and as you can guess, I mean, you can sort of predict what the result will be on the basis of who's got a majority in parliament, which is the ruling party, of course. Zardari, who's stepping down in a month, actually drastically reduced the power of the president in 2010. He sort of stripped away lots of his own powers, which means it's now doesn't have very much real power.
Which is strange, because when you think about Asif Ali al-Zardari, he's a man who may not, as you say, have open power, but you always got the impression that he was pulling strings.
Yes, absolutely, he was. I mean, he was the person who not only was sort of the puppet master of his own party, but also credited with keeping the coalition together for the last 5 years. I mean, he's a very skillful political operator, very charismatic, and there was a sort of quite steadily changing run of prime ministers, actually, people being ousted for various corruption scandals, ousted again, and it was Zardari who was really the sort of dominant face of politics. But it's quite interesting, actually, that he did technically reduce his own powers, and I think we're going to see, with the candidate that Nawaz Sharif, the current prime minister, has put forward, I think we're going to see, he's not... He's a bit of a political nonentity, to be honest. He's not someone who's well known. He's not someone who's had any sort of national political roles before. I think Nawaz Sharif is probably quite consciously doesn't want someone who's going to upstage him.
Okay, so we've got this boycott by the PPP. It sounds like a major concern when such a major party is not taking part in the process. How big a problem is it, given how the details of the election, as you've just explained them?
I think there is always the risk of it sort of undermining the legitimacy, especially when this is actually quite a historic moment. Every other president has been ousted in a military coup or unseated by another government. So just the fact that it's sort of disrupting that smooth transition from one to another, I think, is a cause for concern. On the other hand, it's somewhat symbolic, because even if they had taken part, their candidate wouldn't have won. You know, the PPP are by no means the biggest party. They're actually sort of the third largest party now for the first time ever after Imran Khan's party came in. So they wouldn't have been able to significantly alter the result. But I think there is always the risk when these democratic institutions are so fragile, there's always the risk of undermining them.
What could happen? Because we saw the first democratic election, democratically elected changeover in parliament a few months ago. If you suddenly find yourself back in accusations of infighting, corruption, and this, that, and the other, how destabilising internally is that for Pakistani politics?
I think it's an incredibly fragile thing, I think, Pakistani politics. So, to an extent, I think people sort of expect this infighting, this sort of trying to undermine each other, as it were. But it's quite interesting, actually, the PPP have chosen to do this, because I think one thing people said about Nawaz Sharif during the last parliament, who's the current prime minister, was that he was actually quite good in opposition. He didn't deliberately try to seek to undermine his opponents, which was quite unexpected from him, from what we saw of him in power before, I think. So We must wonder whether this is going to set the tone for the next 5 years. But I think people in general feel more positive about political systems and their validity than they have before.
The relationship between leaders, or at least the prime minister and the military, is a relationship that we think about a lot when we're thinking about Pakistan. I wonder if we see that as a straight line. Is it really a triangle? Is the president a key part of that relationship, and how might he be this time round?
Well, it certainly was. I mean, before Zardari introduced his these amendments in 2010, which drastically reduced the power of the president. The president actually had the power to appoint and dismiss military leaders, as well as to dissolve parliament if he wanted to. The president actually no longer has the power to do that. So I think, as we've seen with Zardari, Emma was saying earlier, you know, that he was a very sort of dominant character in politics. So he sort of dictated the tone of that civilian-military relationship, which, as you say, is absolutely probably the most important relationship in Pakistani politics. Now, I would imagine, with Nawaz Sharif being the sort of main political player, and his president is most likely to be someone who's sort of a fairly quiet man, really. It's probably going to be dictated more by the prime minister.
Samira Shackle, thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. Up next, we speak to a man who's travelled around the world in search of darkness, something you don't find easily these days. Stay with us.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Now, if you go out into the night in one of our major world cities, there's one thing you'll never see: darkness. Natural darkness is disappearing from our cities. In fact, in most big ones, true darkness is simply extinct.
Now, this thought sent one writer on a mission. The author Paul Bogard travelled the globe in search of the world's very darkest night. What he found on his journey has been put into a book. It paints a picture of how artificial light has changed our world, obscuring as many things as it lights up. Our researcher Fernanda Augusta Pacheco asked Paul if darkness really is endangered.
I do think it's disappearing. In many cases, it's really already disappeared. I guess it depends on a helpful way to think of it is what we mean by darkness and different levels of darkness. So if we're thinking of natural darkness, the way it was before electric light, that darkness is gone from every major city in the world. And so we do have something called darkness, but it's not the same as it used to be.
And how is this affecting us?
Well, it's affecting us in a number of ways. Some ways, like human health effects or effects on the environment, are things that we can quantify even. We can assign numbers to and do studies on. But it's also affecting us in ways that are really difficult to quantify or do a study of, like what's the effect on our spiritual life, or what's the effect on our emotional life when we don't have anymore what was for generations a common human experience of walking out to come face to face with the universe.
And I mean, I know you travel around the US and other parts of the globe to research for your book. If I may ask, where do you felt you could see less artificial light?
Well, the easy answer is to get away from the cities and to get away from the larger populations of human beings. It seems like wherever we go, we bring our electric light with us. But some of the best places are, and this is true in Great Britain as well as in the States, are the national parks. These are places that I think are really important when we think about darkness, because not only are many of them remote, but they're also places that we already love, we already know, we already want to protect. And so some of the best work that's going on both here and in Great Britain is to recognize how important darkness is in those places and to protect it there.
What's your connection with darkness? Are you scared, or do you enjoy the darkness?
Well, I would say both, actually. You know, I wrote this book about the value, how important darkness is for us, but I would readily admit to what I think is a natural human fear of the dark. I just think it's something that we've carried with us, and I think that's okay. But what I've added to my fear of the dark is a real understanding of how important darkness is, and therefore a real respect for it. And I'm trying to raise our awareness of the value of darkness so that we stop wasting it unnecessarily.
And it's interesting, in your book you mention as well different work patterns, especially night shifts in particular, and how they affect us. So do you think they kind of increase social deprivation as well?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think it's beyond a doubt that it affects us physically. We're not designed to be awake at night physically, and when you have people who are not getting enough sleep or are being forced to work at night, being forced to be up at night, I would think there would be, I don't know of any studies that make this connection, but it seems to me logical that you could connect some of what is a completely unnatural experience of being up all night long or working at night with, as you say, social deprivation.
But you actually try to live in these conditions for the book, right?
I do. I did try to do it a couple times. And, you know, a lot of people, more and more people around the world are having to work at night, having to be up at night. I found it horrible. I just, you know, I'm not used to it, but I just think I suffered, let's put it that way.
Yes, and that's what I was going to ask as well, how personally affected you are by the artificial light that we have in cities.
Well, I think, you know, because I'm aware of it, I do things like sleep in a dark room and try to get out into places that has less artificial light to experience true darkness. But I'm affected by it like everyone is, in the sense of not having a beautiful night sky to see and, you know, all the ecological and human health effects touch me as much as they touch any of us.
And well, we're talking here about darkness, but actually you mentioned in your book as well that about the brightest spot on the planet.
Sure. The brightest spot is generally acknowledged to be Las Vegas, and specifically the Luxor beam, which is a beam of light that shoots out of the Luxor Casino straight into the sky. But, you know, there are probably dozens of cities around the world that are actually brighter than Las Vegas on a whole, just because they're larger than Las Vegas. But if you want to say what is the brightest spot, it would be the Luxor beam.
Paul Bogard there, author of The End of the Night, speaking to Monocle's researcher Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
So in the Northern Hemisphere, summer is upon us, and many of us will be packing our bags, not forgetting the bucket and spade, of course, and a handy copy of Monocle Mediterraneo, before heading to sunnier climes. If you're a politician, you might feel you need a break even more than the rest of us, but where, how, and when you holiday is a political minefield all of its own.
So all this week on Monocle 24, we're taking a look at the holiday destinations of choice for some of the world's heads of state. Yesterday we heard why France's President Hollande is staying at home this summer. Well, today's Monocle's man in Washington, D.C., Sasha Eisenberg, unpicks the politics of going on vacation for President Obama and the First Family.
The Obamas are heading to Martha's Vineyard, an island off the coast of Massachusetts in the Atlantic, where they've gone every year since he was elected in 2008, and actually a number of years before that while he was a senator. They've sort of fallen into this cycle of spending their Augusts in Martha's Vineyard on the East Coast, and then around Christmas heading to Hawaii, where Obama was raised, where he has a number of childhood friends and some family members, and you get beach access in both places, and I think December's a nicer time to get as far away from the East Coast as possible. Obama has, I think, sort of marked himself as somebody who's not interested in using his vacation to leave a political mark. The most famous example of this is Bill Clinton in 1995, as he was preparing to run for re-election. His personal poll numbers weren't great at the time, and he actually had his pollster test different vacation destinations to see how they would play with voters. Instead, he went to Wyoming.
Now, after a meal, there's nothing like a good cigar.
think there's still pictures of him and Hillary on horseback. The Obamas haven't done that. I think part of that is having younger daughters than Clinton did. I think that there's a little bit more of a sense that, this is family time. And I also think that some of it is Obama's far less of a political animal than Clinton was, and probably not counting electoral votes when picking out the, sort of patch of beach where he wants to spend his summer. And one of the advantages of being president is that you can use the Secret Service to obviously not only offer protection, but a fair bit of a buffer for press coverage. And so while there are media who get often a picture a day if Obama goes out and gets an ice cream cone or goes to a bookstore, he's allowed to live his life in private. So they're not images of the multi-million dollar house that he's renting. It allows some control of the imagery, at least, so you're not seeing a president who's living a life sort of at odds with people who are suffering. I think that the obvious counterexample of this is somebody who's now rather close to the Obama White House, John Kerry, who in 2004, while a candidate for president, went to Nantucket and went windsurfing. This got picked up at a distance by video cameras and used by Republicans by the Bush campaign that year and to mock him in one of the most sort of devastating political ads. Just a couple weeks ago, Kerry was on a yacht off of Nantucket. It emerged when news was breaking in Cairo.
While the crisis was unfolding in Egypt this week, a small controversy was brewing on the whereabouts of the Secretary of State, John Kerry. White House photos show the president and his national security team gathered in the Situation Room. A CBS News producer reported Kerry was, in fact, aboard his boat in Nantucket that day.
But if you're president, one of the advantages is that you can pretty much make sure that if you go on a yacht or engage in sort of flamboyant water sports, that you can keep cameras far enough at bay to at least keep the images out of the papers. The president brings a sort of core staff with him wherever he goes, a national security advisor, a couple of domestic advisors, a small communications team. He's getting briefings every day, and as news breaks, he responds, and I don't think there's been a presidential vacation going back decades where the president hasn't at some point come out and had to give a statement on camera or respond to events. And it turns out that, you know, news happens in August. It was George H.W. Bush was on his summer vacation in Maine when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and so the sort of famous image of the first U.S. response is him in vacation wear standing a rather nice summery tableau far from the Rose Garden declaring America's national interest. So it's entirely possible that Obama will be put to work again this summer.
Monocle's Washington correspondent there, Sasha Eisenberg, with the second installment of our week-long series of presidential postcards. Tomorrow, an epistle from Italy. We'll ask how new Prime Minister Enrico Letta is attempting to distance himself from the holiday choices of his flamboyant forebear, Mr. Berlusconi. That's tomorrow, right here on Midori House.
Not difficult, I'd argue. In the next half hour of today's programme, however, we'll speak to our man in Jakarta and we'll visit a new exhibition at London's Design Museum to hear what manufacturing techniques are going to look like in tomorrow's world.
We've gone from that model of investing a lot of money in machinery so you can make lots of things cheaply to a moment when you don't actually have to make a very complicated machine to make some simple things. And that's gathering pace.
That's all to come. Let's hear from Barney first with your news headlines.
Thanks, Dom. More than 100 Taliban fighters and 7 suicide bombers have attacked a prison in northwestern Pakistan. A Taliban spokesman claims around 300 prisoners were freed in the attack. Talks have resumed between Israeli officials and Palestinians at a dinner in Washington. The initial discussions hosted by the United States are being described as an important step towards full peace talks, and more meetings will take place later in the day. Supporters of the deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi have vowed to hold further protests on Tuesday despite the bloodshed at the weekend when 80 Islamist supporters were gunned down. The EU's top diplomat, Catherine Ashton, held 2 hours of talks with Mr. Morsi in Cairo last night. The sheriff's office in Lake County, Central Florida, says all the workers at a propane gas factory near Orlando have now been accounted for and nobody has been killed after a series of large explosions. 7 people were injured. Lawmakers in Britain say the battle against internet crime is being lost. They're calling for the establishment of a new crack crime unit to fight the growing problem in cooperation with the UK's global partners, including particularly the European Union. And the countdown to Brazil hosting the next Summer Olympics has begun, with a ceremony to mark 1,100 days until the event. At an event at the United Nations a year after London hosted the Games, the UK's ambassador to the UN handed a symbolic baton to his Brazilian counterpart. And those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news, after which point Sophie Grove will take over to bring you this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs. In the meantime, though, you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds, where the time here in London is just nudging 8:35 a.m.
Now, an ambitious new exhibition has just opened at the Design Museum in London. It's called The Future Is Here, and it claims to show that the design age we live in is as exciting and as revolutionary as it's ever been.
The exhibition claims that recent developments in the way we produce objects now bring designers, manufacturers and consumers closer than ever before. Small companies can now compete in a market once dominated by big players. We sent Annabelle Bly to find out more.
I'm Dejan Sujic, director of the Design Museum. This is probably the year that what were subjects familiar to the nerds escaped out of the laboratory in the back room and into public consciousness. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen Maplin produce for sale the first less than £800 3D printer. The Sun put an image of what was claimed to be the first home-printed firearm a few months ago. So we've really been thinking about these issues for a while. We've been thinking about what's already here, things that are not far distant technologies, but existing ones. What's the impact that that's going to have? And try to assemble it in a way which is accessible, which tries to show what new materials, new sourcing methods, new means of distribution, new techniques are going to do, not just to designers, but to the world around us.
Yeah, so I guess the exhibition is prefixed on this idea of a new industrial revolution. Perhaps you could tell me a little bit more about what that actually means to the everyday consumer, as well as manufacturing and designers as well.
150 years ago, some apparently random technological innovations, the steam engine, railways, textile mills, transformed the world. All sorts of unexpected consequences were the product of that. The shape of cities everywhere was transformed. 60 years ago, a very low-tech thing called the sea container had another impact almost as violent. It allowed globalization, manufacturing in China. The shipping container, this metal box, suddenly transformed the landscape of cities around the world. It meant the end of city center docks, for example. We're now on the edge of something which could have equally profound consequences. The idea that you don't need to invest in a factory anymore, that you can actually make things at home. It's saying that the design process is going to be quite different, and people's relationships with their objects is also going to be completely different. They can be in control of them. We've gone from that model of investing a lot of money in machinery so you can make lots of things cheaply to a moment when you don't actually have to make a very complicated machine to make some simple things. And that's gathering pace. And we're just trying to explore what that really means for us all.
My name's Alex Newson. I'm the curator of The Future Is Here, A New Industrial Revolution at the Design Museum in London.
Perhaps you could tell me a bit about how you sort of brought all the core ideas of this new industrial revolution together into an exhibition itself.
Well, I think there's quite a lot of complex ideas in here, and that was one of the things that worried us to start with. We're trying to communicate things that can be quite complicated and technological to a general audience in many ways. You can't pick up the paper or turn on the radio without hearing someone talk about 3D printing, but I think people still don't really know what it is. So one of the key things that we did is have a section right at the beginning of the exhibition that demystifies all of these technologies. So we have a section explaining each of the key technologies, such as 3D printing, such as computer-aided design, such as digital knitting and weaving, and something called CNC, which is computer numerically controlled, which is essentially plugging a computer into a manufacturing machine. So we take those different technologies apart. So we explain them to the visitor, we show what they can do, have examples of what they can do, and we talk to people who use them and get them to have an interview and a video interview to explain them. And then in a way, visitors then have the vocabulary that they need to understand the rest of the exhibition.
Yeah, I mean, the exhibition is fantastically interactive, and there's even a design factory at the start. Could you tell me how that sort of fits in?
Well, I think early on we realised that things have to be active. If you have an exhibition about making things without things being made, you've kind of stumbled at the first hurdle in a way. However, that's very hard, because making things for a 3-month, 4-month exhibition is very difficult. You can do it for a one-off day, an hour here and there, but it's quite tough to do for 4 months in a row. So we came up with the idea of actually testing out the theory that you hear people talking about the barriers to access being lowered and everyone can now become a digital designer maker. We thought, well, is that true? Is that just something that people say, or how accurate actually is it? So we've got six of our front of house staff that we've had trained in how to use the equipment. I say trained, they've had 2 days training, so it's very limited training, and they've had no experience in digital making or manufacturing before, and we've let them loose using these digital desktop manufacturing machines to see what they can create. And I think their failures are going to be just as important as their successes, and we want them to engage with the audience to talk about what they're doing, to explain the processes, to talk about their struggles, talk about the things they're pleased with, and I think that all adds to the experience for the visitors as well.
My name's David Bott, I'm the Director of Innovation Programmes at the Technology Strategy Board, the UK's innovation agency. So we've been working with the design community a bit. The Technology Strategy Board is 6 years old, six in a couple of weeks now. But about 2 years ago, we saw a talk by Dan Sujic, the Chief Executive of the Design Museum, on the original Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, and how because you were going from making tens of things to hundreds of thousands of things, you had to get the design right, else they wouldn't sell. So effectively, the last Industrial Revolution drove design and technology together. Since then, for a variety of reasons, they've been driven apart. And the, you know, the talk was about some of the factors. But we sat and talked about it afterwards and realised that we had an opportunity to recognise and celebrate those people who did still bring design and technology together and use that as, you know, almost a role model for other people.
Perhaps I could get you to talk me through some of the core developments in the technology that we've been talking about that are on display in the exhibition here at the Design Museum.
Okay, so one of the big things is that we've got here is this additive layer manufacturing, which is a technique that's been around for about 20 years in one form or another. And what it does is it lays down a structure layer by layer. So you can make structures that it's impossible to make by conventional manufacturing. You can make, you know, re-entrant curves and things with holes in the middle that you couldn't make any other way. So, you know, you can't take a block of aluminium and leave a hole in the middle, but with additive layer manufacturing, you can make something with a hole in the middle. So it's complete, giving us a completely different set of mechanical design rules, but also aesthetic design rules. So that's where the customization comes in, because you can make things that look good as well as do the right thing. You can do it for plastics, you can do it for metals, you can do it for ceramics. And the technology has been developing over the last few years. And, you know, as Dan was saying in the introduction, the first sub-£800 3D printing machine is now available at Maplin. It makes plastics, it doesn't make metals or ceramics and such, but it makes something you can have. There's lots of applications where that will really make a difference. It's changing the way the market operates as much as anything.
David Bott from the UK's Innovation Agency, ending that report from Annabel Bly for this week's edition of Section D. You can catch the weekly design programme tonight at 2100 hours if you're in Istanbul, and 1400 hours if you're listening in Washington.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with our man in Jakarta.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 14:43 in Jakarta, 8:43 a.m. here in London. You're with Midori House.
Now, our man in Jakarta is just back from a trip to Papua New Guinea. He joins us on the line with the things he wants to talk about from his travels. Ben Bland, welcome back to Midori House. So, you've been to Papua New Guinea. What have you learnt? What do you want to talk to us about today?
Well, yeah, it's funny that I found it easier to get to Papua New Guinea, which is
the independent country on one half of the island of Papua, then the Indonesian half of Papua, where ironically I need special permission from the foreign ministry to visit, which is pretty hard to get. So I had a very interesting trip to one of the last frontier nations, really, in Asia Pacific. Papua New Guinea is a country of 7 million people. It's one of the poorest countries in the world with a very high crime rate, but it also has an emerging, booming resource economy.
We're looking at big internet multinationals are moving in there as well, aren't we?
Yeah, well, there are very big reserves of oil and gas, gold and copper, and the whole economy really has been turbocharged in the last few years by a $19 billion ExxonMobil gas project, and the investment for that project alone is bigger than the whole of the existing PNG economy. That's really pushed the whole country ahead. There's been a huge inflow of money, but there seems to be a slowdown coming because at the height of the construction for this project, which required them to build everything from scratch in the middle of the jungle, there were some 20,000 people employed. That's expected to fall to just a few hundred by the time the project comes on stream in 2014. So in the meantime, there's a bit of a struggle for this young country to find jobs for these people and other drivers for economic growth.
Indeed, and it seems that when we're talking about Papua New Guinea, it's often in terms of economic potential on the one hand and social ills on the other. And I gather that the unemployment issues and problems with the police are fueling gang culture.
Yes, Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea, is known as one of the world's most dangerous capital cities, and that's with good reason. Because of the economic growth that's been taking place, there has been a large shift of population to the city, which is growing very fast. But you know, the formal sector jobs haven't really grown alongside the population shift to the city, with the result that there are huge numbers of young people with very limited education because of problems in the school system and very few formal employment opportunities. So many of them, unfortunately, are turning to crime. And that's really been allowed to happen because the police are just not a visible presence in Papua New Guinea. The population of the country has maybe tripled in the last 20 or 30 years, but the number of police has remained static. And you know, the only security presence you see on the streets of Port Moresby are the G4S security guards, who are pretty ubiquitous. It's very rare to see a police officer.
Nonetheless, despite this deprivation and violence, you have this completely counterintuitive problem of it being an incredibly expensive place to live.
Yeah, well, Papua New Guinea is a bit of a slice in Asia of some of these resource curse problems that we've seen in the west of Africa, for example, where a number of large resource projects bring in a huge amount of money and create jobs and push the economy as a whole, but they also drive inequality. And that means in Port Moresby, we've seen the prices of property and food rise to astronomical levels. I mean, a three-bedroom, pretty humble family house is going to rent for $2,000-$4,000 a month. A kilogram of local tomatoes costs as much as $8, and that's because of the poor infrastructure, which means it's hard for farmers to sell their produce, and because of this new demand, which can't be met by Papua New Guineans, so a lot of products are imported at great cost.
Ben, our man in Jakarta, recently back from Papua New Guinea. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
Now, before we leaf through today's British papers with our resident Welshman, Thomas Lewis, we'll have some music. And I asked Thomas earlier on today, Tom, in your head, what's the internal kind of monologue? What's your theme tune that's playing all the time, and especially when you come and join us for paper reviews? And he said, Dom, it's this.
Streetwise earth leads the pie to rise in us.
Right then, that was Bonnie Tyler, gravelly faced. No, gravelly faced, good lord, no.
That's outrageous.
Bonnie Tyler's going to bring Moya's gravelly face right to Midori House.
Gravelly voice.
Ouch.
Well, anyway, she was singing "Where Have All the Good Men Gone" in that amazing song, I Need a Hero. Well, frankly, we've just found one for us. Thomas Lewis, resident Welshman. That's your anthem, isn't it?
Yes, I'm feeling G'd up and ready to go.
My heart's going pitter-pat, I must confess. How about you, Don? Are you all right?
It's kind of going pitter-pat.
You were trying not to backcomb your hair, weren't you, Emma, through that?
I've actually gone and got a crimp in the middle of that.
Very little music makes it hard not to backcomb your hair, but that one does. Incredible power. Where do you want to start, Tom?
Well, we'll start with The Independent, and it's this story. It was a story around yesterday, but it's gaining sort of steam today. It was a story about Caroline Criado-Perez. She's a feminist writer here in the UK. She was campaigning to get a woman's face on the banknotes here in the UK.
Jane Austen.
She succeeded, yes. Jane Austen, it was announced, is going to be the face of one of the banknotes here when they are reprinted in a few years' time. But it turns out while she was running that very high-profile campaign, she was the victim of a lot of sexist abuse, and a lot of it quite grim, in fact, and quite threatening.
It wasn't just abuse, it was threat. It was rape threats.
Yes, and death threats too, I believe. So this led a lot of prominent women MPs here in the UK to throw their voices into the debate. Yvette Cooper, who's a very senior opposition politician here, wrote a letter to Twitter yesterday saying that it was their responsibility to put some features into Twitter so that people could report this more easily, because it wasn't just a matter of throwaway comments. Actually, this stuff really was quite serious.
Well, it seems to be that there's a sort of a slight change in what is considered the appropriate approach to take on social networks, and particularly this one in particular. Because once upon a time, they'd say, don't feed the trolls. Essentially, don't, you know, when you're being bullied in the playground, you just don't respond and they'll stop. But it seems now that the contrary is being suggested, and the idea should be that we really do something, that we take people on and we send police around to their house, and that's the only way it'll stop.
Absolutely. That is definitely the message that's coming out of this, and the sense is that a line has been crossed. Now, another Labour MP in the papers today has come out since this, the developments of yesterday, Stella Creasy. Now, the Independent prints out one of the tweets that she received, and it's really pretty vile and pretty grim stuff.
Now, this is where I start to have a problem with this story, and I found myself consciously avoiding this story yesterday for the simple reason that I have a funny feeling that repetition of these horrible things that are being said actually encourages it. And I was just looking at this and I found myself fascinated by what vile things were being said in the papers. Yeah. And I thought, actually, if you just don't cover it and you shut it down, or you take a responsible attitude to the way that it's reported, then you could actually possibly.
And I think the reporting has been pretty responsible across the board, in that, like you, Emma, you have a sort of strange purient interest in saying, what are these morons actually saying? And mostly, It has gone unreported. Perhaps The Independent, if it has printed something, is one of the few that has.
The Independent, it has a smattering of quotes, but none of them are nice. I mean, they're really horrible, frankly.
But that's quite an interesting thought, too, because Mary Beard, who's a very prominent Cambridge academic here in the UK, she too has come out and said that she, after she appeared on one of the political talk shows here, was receiving some pretty nasty stuff, too. And she said her way of dealing with that was to retweet them, to name and shame, effectively. So perhaps, Dom, you know, by printing word for word, and for people to see with their own eyes how graphic and how grim this is, then actually, you know, it will be a case of people thinking, oh, well, actually, this is a bit embarrassing now. I don't want to be known as this guy who tweets this kind of stuff to women across the country.
And I guess a sort of a broad change in the assumption of how we think of these people, so that we don't think, wow, someone said something aggressive and strange, but oh dear, that sad man sat in his pants in his parents' basement, or whatever it is these people should be characterized.
And I think obviously they are trying to make a political point out of this, which maybe takes away the gratuitous emeritus, maybe of sort of pre-printing some of this text. And I think the fact that these senior women politicians are coming out now means that they're maybe is adding some legitimacy to the debate and actually some weight to getting this problem solved.
Now, let's have a look at the story that you brought in from the Daily Telegraph here in the United Kingdom. A tube station is for sale, yours for £20 million. Not just any tube station, though.
No, not just any tube station. So it's the Brompton Road tube station. It's been out of action for really quite some while. It was opened right at the turn of the century, but it closed in 1934 because not enough people were using it. But then as Second World War unfolded, the Ministry of War bought it and used it as the headquarters.
I do like the idea of a Ministry of War.
Well, those are the days when you needed one,
yes,
frankly,
absolutely.
Weren't they?
And not basically, defence, but war.
No, absolutely. And they used it as the HQ for the anti-aircraft defences during the Blitz and as Hitler's Air Force was really sort of destroying large swathes of London. And it's really got some really lovely, quite interesting little stories, little snapshots from those dark days here in London. There were rumours that Rudolf Hess actually was questioned there in the tube station in 1941 when he took this secret flight on his way to Scotland, apparently to try and negotiate peace. Obviously that didn't come to anything. But yeah, this can be yours for £20 million, Emma.
I wonder who would buy it? Because at the moment, large swathes of London are being bought by Hong Kong, quite a lot of Arab investment, big investment from China as well. They are all trying to redevelop bits of London. But one does wonder what you would actually do with a place that Rudolf Hess was questioned in. I mean, you can't really sort of turn it into a luxury bathroom, can you?
Probably not.
No, well, you could, but it might have a bit of a funny feeling to it.
Yes, and the Daily Telegraph doesn't really go into the details of what you might be able to turn it into, but obviously your imagination can fill in the blanks, I imagine.
There is that also interesting idea at the moment that's being mooted, which is the selling of London's tube stations to gain revenue for TfL, Transport for London, so that, for example, you would have, you know how Emirates is sponsoring the cable car. You would have certain companies sponsoring different tube stops. And I wonder, you know, where London is going, where international capitals are going for branding.
Well, I guess that's where the tube network started, didn't it? It started with individual companies starting up in little lines of their own, and eventually they sort of brought it together for the benefit of travellers. But it is interesting. Tom, 20 seconds, tell us about the last story you've got for us.
So apparently the McDouble, so the feast you can buy at a McDonald's near you, is apparently the cheapest and most nutritious meal ever produced for a mass market.
Right.
Basically, the writer Stephen Dubner, who authored the wildly selling Freakonomics book, says that he looked into this, and the amount of calories, the amount of protein, the amount of fat actually makes this a pretty nutritious meal. If you know, that's all you can afford for about $2 or so, that actually it'll see you in good stead.
I see a diet book being written about it now. Tom Lewis, thank you very much indeed. Our resident Welsh hero.
That is all we have time for today. Marcus Hippie produced the show. It was researched by Elena Falco and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Toby Hammond was the studio manager.
Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs, but from me, Emma Nelson.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.